From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, just who's paying for all those campaign ads flooding our TV screens? The answer, big outsiders with deep pockets.
To keep everything on the up and up, transparency is inoculation against corruption.
The voting deadline draws near for Detroit workers and retirees. Will they say yes to the grand bargain?
As things stand right now, the votes are being tallied by a firm based in California.
Plus, how Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan is winning important allies.
He's proof that leadership style matters.
And with the 4th of July at hand, we get up close and personal with the Star Spangled Banner.
We sing it so much that, in fact, we don't really know much about this song at all.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Who is paying for those campaign ads that we've been watching in Michigan? You know, those ads for the U.S. Senate and governor's races. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, a new report finds of the $18 million that's been spent on campaign TV ads over the first half of this year in Michigan, outside groups kicked in $14 million of that money. We'll ask who's working so hard to flood the airwaves and how might it impact the way you vote. But first, the clock is ticking. Detroit's bankruptcy settlement has gotten through the state legislature. It's gotten through the private foundations. Now it's up to 32,000 city employees and retirees. They are being asked to say yes to having their pensions cut, promising not to sue the city. In return, the pension cuts will not be as severe as they would be under what's become known as the grand bargain. Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter Sarah Swick joins us now. Sarah, the deadline is next Friday. What do we know about where the voting is right now?
As things stand right now, the votes are being tallied by a firm based in California that apparently has some expertise in doing these sorts of votes and seems to have a pretty good, solid reputation nationwide. We don't know the tally exactly, and there are a few reasons for that.
Well, Sarah, we certainly heard some hue and cry over the fact that Kevin Orr seemed to have access to the results as the company is getting the ballots. Tell us about that.
Right. This isn't a regular election in which you have a right to a secret ballot. There's transparency in the process to the people who are counting the votes and to the people that have access to it. And obviously, each retiree or creditor's vote is tied to them in particular, so people know how you voted. But when Kevin Orr did come out about a month ago now on Mackinac and say that things, retiree votes seem to be running about 2-1 in favor of approving the plan of adjustment, that is, there was a big outcry over that. And people expressed, you know, even some experts on this were kind of like, well, you're really not supposed to do that. And then just about a week ago or so in court, Judge Rhodes admonished city officials and said, yeah, you probably don't want to be releasing or talking about results, ongoing tallies as the votes are still coming in.
That was probably akin to kind of keeping the tip of your finger on the weighing scale, huh, as things are being weighed.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense that as long as the vote is going on, it shouldn't be discussed publicly, at least by, you know, the people, by city officials and people who are, you know, influencing the process or have some stake in the outcome. Now, interestingly enough, Mayor Mike Duggan came out fairly recently, and he's been pretty muted about talking about any bankruptcy issues because he has a power sharing agreement with Kevin Orr, in which Orr runs the bankruptcy side of things, and Duggan runs the day-to-day city operation side of things. But Duggan said something to the effect of, city retirees should really vote for the plan of adjustment. This is a good deal for them, and encourage that.
Something we need to probably touch on, Sarah, is the fact that we're looking at two different classifications, correct, of city workers and the retirees. So some people have more skin in the game than others.
Yeah, exactly. So police and fire retirees are looking at fewer cuts than the general system retirees. They won't take any direct hit to their pension, whereas this is assuming that the plan of adjustment is approved. The general system retirees will take a roughly 4.5% cut to their pension. There's also reductions in cost of living adjustments, and it will actually be eliminated for general system retirees. And then there's something else going on called the clawback, in which various annuities that had been invested in over the years, that the city would kind of take some of that money back or reduce the payments, you know, in line and with what they think they should have been getting all along, basically. And I think there is some, I did talk to one retiree, general system retiree, who thought it wasn't fair that police and fire were getting better treatment than just the general retirees. But, you know, that's the way it is. That's the way it worked out. And most people seem to think that police and fire should get a little bit more.
So timetable, we know that the deadline to vote is the 11th. How long might it be until we hear the final decision?
I actually don't really know. But the plan of adjustment, the trial for the plan of adjustment is now, it's been moved back now a couple times, but it's set to start in mid-August. So I would assume the results, they would have the results by that point, so they know what they're looking, exactly what the situation is going forward, as, you know, Judge Rhodes, who's, you know, the bankruptcy court judge, and he's the one who's going to make the ultimate decision about pretty much all these things. So I think we should know by then.
And leading up to this July 11th deadline, so in the next week, what should we keep our eye on, Sarah?
Any more sort of statements, or I don't think Kevin Orr is going to be coming out and saying anything else about the vote tally anymore. but just sort of any efforts to try to persuade retirees who may not have cast their ballot yet to vote one way or the other.
I guess that does it. So really, it's a waiting game for everybody involved.
It really is. Yes.
Michigan Radio, Sarah Swick. Always good to talk with you, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There seems to be very little doubt that Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan is making his mark. His bulldog nature, his political instincts, they've combined to make Duggan a force to be reckoned with, even as he has to serve under a state-appointed emergency manager. Mike Duggan's been on the job for 6 months, and today Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes reviews that time in office. Daniel, you say the mayor gives himself a grade of incomplete, but I've got to figure no one should be surprised at that.
No, they shouldn't. And I think nor should people be so impatient to expect that he changes the world in 6 months. You know, he's facing a mountain of challenges that won't be overcome in 1 year, one term, or even one decade. But I think that what's important here is the process and the direction. And the direction is clearly positive. It's bipartisan. He's clearly repaired relationships with city council, and specifically Council President Brenda Jones, who went from being a reliable member of the no caucus in the last council to being very much a supporter and working with the mayor on a lot of interesting issues.
What do you think? How did that happen? What has he done, do you think, to really bring Brenda Jones so solidly onto his team?
A very radical idea in terms, I would assume, into just treating her with respect and recognizing that, you know, she's in that position for a reason, and the voters put her there, and or the council put her there after the, mm-hmm. the election. And he's treating, I think, a lot of players. I mean, he's not being partisan, overtly partisan. He's working well with Republicans. He's gotten some interesting legislation through the legislature, including the Detroit Rescue Package, packages supportive of blight and other things. And to do that, as a Detroit mayor, you've got to deal with Republican leadership in Lansing who are not from Detroit. And he has shown a real knack for that. And I think it's indicative of his style. I quote somebody in the column talking about how blown away they are by what he's accomplished, and he's proof that leadership style matters. And I think we have other examples in Southeast Michigan of leadership style mattering. I mean, Alan Mulally, who just left Ford mm-hmm. Motor Company, is a classic example of that. But when you think about the difference between a Dave Bing and a Mike Duggan as mayor, and if you just focus on relationships with council alone, it's a dramatic departure. And I think the business community, the foundation community, the nonprofits, the state political community, they all see this. We live in a 24/7 wired world. There are very few secrets about these kinds of things. And as they see this, that it has a dividend all its own. And I think one of them is it will tend to give Detroit the benefit of the doubt,
uh-huh.
and the mayor the benefit of the doubt when he comes asking for things, when he needs support, and whether businesses are going to invest in Detroit.
Now, have you heard from anyone who has expressed doubts about anything he's done or anything in his style?
Yes, and I talk about it a little bit in the column. I think people, they also see in Mike Duggan a guy who is a bit of a control freak, who prizes loyalty among just about any other attribute in people who work for him. There are a lot of people who he worked with at Wayne County and then brought to Detroit Medical Center who are now working in his administration. And some people, I think that's a bad sign.
The word cronyism sometimes gets tossed around?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that can be a bad sign, but I think you have to weigh it against results. And if they're able to continue this forward progress and get results and keep the tone positive and attack some of the problems that affect the quality of life in the city, I think at least for the people who write the checks to support someone like that,
mm-hmm.
Or to support the city, they're willing to, I think, look past that as long as they're getting results on the other side.
Yeah, because I have to say, so what if they're familiar faces who have traveled, if he knows that they can do things effectively and more competently, and that's happening, who cares?
I think, in large part, I agree with you, and I think that's kind of where people are right now. Now, if his administration starts getting mired in scandal, if they start doing some really dumb things, which we've seen legions of coming out of City Hall over the last however many years,
sure.
That's a different story. But I don't really expect to see that near term.
Mm.
I think he's got a very unique window here with Kevin Orr as the emergency manager. Between Kevin Orr as emergency manager, who's doing kind of the ugly restructuring of the city's balance sheet, and the business and foundation community focusing a lot on downtown, that both of those things kind of free the mayor up to really train his attention on the neighborhoods, on quality of life issues, on the kinds of things that don't necessarily benefit the Dan Gilberts and the Mike Illiches. They benefit people out in the broader community. That's good for him politically, and it's good for the citizens, and it's good for the Detroit story.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with our Thursday check-in. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It can be stirring and glorious, but it can also be one of the easiest tunes to sing badly, really badly. Our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. The history of the Star-Spangled Banner is absolutely fascinating. Bart Clegg is a musicologist with the University of Michigan, and he joins us to talk about his project, Poets and Patriots, A Tuneful History of the Star-Spangled Banner. Mark, what does this project try to accomplish?
Well, basically, the Star-Spangled Banner is turning 200 years old this year in September, and I've been getting ready for this day for like 10 years. I mean, I just want to have the biggest birthday party possible for the national anthem. And I think what's really interesting to me about it is that the story behind this ritual that we know from every sporting event, from graduations,
enough.
We sing it all the time. We sing it so much that, in fact, we don't really know much about this song at all.
No.
And it turns out that the story of Francis Scott Key and this anthem and the actual dozens and dozens of versions of lyrics to this and different melodies and changes in musical style and approach, I just find it endlessly engaging for me, and it really gets at this issue of the power of this song. I mean, I think for me personally, but for so many of us.
Well, it's persisted. We haven't thrown it out and replaced
Absolutely.
It when you think about it all these years.
Exactly. There are lots of reasons why people don't like the Star-Spangled Banner. It's too hard to sing. It's associated with war. You know, it has this reputation as a drinking song.
These
sort of this colored history and colorful history. And I think that's, for me, what's really cool is that when you start to get into it, it really is a kind of story of America because we're complicated. We've had to compromise. We have all these different voices, all these different people coming together that have made this democratic experiment really work. And for me, the song tells that same story in a sort of vivid in an emotional and fun way.
Well, take us through first the history of the melody before it became something that Francis Scott Key knew enough about to be able to set his lyrics to. So do we know who the composer is and who and when it was written? Who wrote it and when?
We do. So it actually dates from the time of our own Revolutionary War, 1775-76. And I think it's sort of fun. The composer's name is probably the sort of ultimate American name, even though This guy is an English composer. His name is John Smith. So John Stafford Smith, to be accurate. And he was a church musician and a professional keyboardist, harpsichordist. But he also was an award-winning composer of popular song. And so this amateur musicians club that was a pretty, you know, classy and classical group of men who would get together, have a symphony concert, have a big dinner, and then sing songs for the rest of the evening. Mm-hmm. They would introduce the song portion of the evening with their club anthem. And so the Anacreontic song is a story, and it has lots of allusions to sort of Greek mythology and the poet Anacreon. And Stafford Smith set this to music.
Besides, I'll instruct you like me to entwine the myrtle of Venus with the curses mine.
So did the lyrics exist and then he matched the music, or did he come up with the melody first?
That's a good question. I think probably the lyrics were written first and then the melody was done to match it. So the lyrics were written by a member of the club, Rafe Tomlinson. The music and the popularity of the club really explode at the same time, such that although this is a club song, it becomes parodied in theaters in London and becomes known in the early United States as well. So Francis Scott Key knew this tune. One of the myths I'm trying to correct about the story that we don't really know about the Star-Spangled Banner is that it wasn't someone else who put text and tune together. It was Francis Scott Key. I mean, you don't accidentally write a lyric to this really what's a sort of a funny melody. It's yes. 8 lines long. It has 9 rhymes and 8 lines. I mean, it's a very specific poetic form. And it was a very popular poetic form. So what Francis Scott Key does is something we call the broadside ballad tradition. And it's something, you know, we're not so familiar with today where you can, you know, recording and you can put stuff out on the internet. If you want to celebrate a song, you just put it out there.
Sure.
You know, in like, you know, 1814 when this song was written, publishing music, there's no recording extant, right? It's expensive to put out music notation. So what you did is you just put lyrics in the newspaper and you gave a hint of a popular melody that everybody already knew, and they sang the day's events, you know, something you wanted to celebrate, you know, some kind of event, a birthday, an anniversary, or in the case of Francis Scott Key, an unexpected and pivotal victory in the War of 1812.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan musicologist Mark Clegg as we talk about the Poets and Patriots Project that is really taking us all through the years in the history of our national anthem. And I'm interested in how this song that was banged out by Francis Scott Key to celebrate, as you say, a pivotal victory in the War of 1812, how did it make its way from being a patriotic chest thumper to the national anthem of the United States of America, a very lofty position?
Well, it took a long time. It took 117 years. So it doesn't become the official national anthem until, believe it or not, 1931. So it hasn't even been a century since it's been our national anthem. People think, oh, it must be like 1776.
Absolutely.
But no, it's actually quite recent. But it, in many ways, the story of our recordings is that it became the national anthem for all practical purposes long before the government got around to recognizing it and President Hoover signed
like a de facto national anthem.
Exactly. So it's really – it starts right in the aftermath of the War of 1812 and that victory. And there's sort of a beginning of sort of a coherent, you know, patriotism in the United States. And that's growing gradually up and through the Civil War. And the Civil War is sort of a key moment. At the beginning of the Civil War, interestingly enough, both the North and the South claim all of America's symbols for themselves. So the Confederacy is saying Francis Scott Key is one of ours. He's a Southerner. You know, he's from Maryland, the slave state. He's, you know, his family has been in this area forever, and this is our song and our flag. And in fact, we need to protect this sort of these wonderful symbols from the Yankees.
Yes. Right?
And then, of course, the Union is saying we need to keep everything together. We're going to use these symbols like the flag and the song as a way of pulling those together. So one of the sort of most interesting thing is that both sides write different lyrics using the Star Spangled Banner melody for campaign songs. There's a campaign song for Lincoln. There's a campaign song for his competitors, all, again, using that same tune. And we've recorded these. So there's a tune called The Flag of Secession, right, which is about the South breaking away.
The pumpkins for fair, the foul-feeted air, gave proof through the night that the Yankees were there. Now the flag of secession in triumph doth wave.
And there's a song called Our Country's Free Flag,
which
is from the North.
From.
Yeah, exactly. So both sides are using this melody as a way of getting their word out there and saying that what's at stake is the very identity of our country. And they're using this song and the flag that are so intimately married. You know, from the moment that Francis Scott Key sees that flag over Fort mm-hmm. McHenry, it's really the song becomes the oral equivalent of the symbol of that canvas flag.
And the flag was still there.
The flag was still there. And so it's that marriage of flag and song that really has I think, put it so deeply into the American spirit.
But alas, we must say, in all sadness this day, some stars have seceded and wandered away, and we go to reclaim them.
Down through the years, Mark, have there been serious contenders to knock the Star-Spangled Banner off that front track of becoming our anthem? I mean, I think of the Battle Hymn of the Republic or America the Beautiful.
Right. The Star-Spangled Banner, because it's been the sort of witness to these pivotal moments in our sort of nation's history when the identity of the country has been at stake, I think it's become the national anthem really despite any kind of decision making. I mean, many people would love to see America the Beautiful be our national anthem. I mean, it's a gorgeous song.
Easier
it's sort
to
of
sing.
Spiritual. It sort of embraces the country from sea to shining sea. It's easier to sing, exactly. But, you know, the affect of that song is a kind of sort of reverie or reverence. And one of the things about a national anthem, I mean, the reason I think we sort of sing it before football games or baseball games, it's about – I mean – sports is a kind of ritual of war, right? You have different teams against each other. They're fighting it out. They're trying to be heroic. So there's this singing our national anthem, which has this really wide melody, right? It has what musicians would call an interval of the 12th. I mean, most national anthems are really narrow. You know, they're almost sort of dirges. You know, you're just very few notes, actually. Our national anthem has basically 12 notes from top to bottom. But the kind of effort and heroism, the vocal heroism, the kind of commitment it takes to make that melody come off, I think is part of the spirit that we need from a national anthem. We turn to a national anthem when the country feels threatened, when we have to really defend ourselves, when we have to make something happen. It's a kind of call to action. And I think the Star-Spangled Banner galvanizes people for action in a way that America the Beautiful probably really can't. So in peacetime, America Beautiful makes sense. Mm-hmm. In wartime, you need something different, and the Star-Spangled Banner fits that mold. And I don't see it going away, despite all of the reasons why we could say, well, you know, it's a British tune, and it's, you know, it's sort of antiquated language, and it's hard to sing, and it's, you know, it has this drinking song reputation.
Mm-hmm.
22 of these 37 tracks, I think, it's the first time ever they've been recorded, because they were written before recording was invented, and then they were forgotten about. And, you know, it's amazing to me that I've found literally hundreds of lyrics to this song. Every time I dig in, we find another one. And it's really just an incredible, incredible story.
Well, the national anthem has been performed in so many ways, and there really is no one correct way to sing it, right?
Right. So we've recorded the original version, the very first sheet music imprint of the Star-Spangled Banner, which we actually have at the University of Michigan in our Clements Library. It's one of 12 surviving copies. And it's actually the most valuable piece of sheet music in history. It's one piece of paper, folds in half, and it's worth $500,000 at auction, at least the most recent one. It doesn't get sold too often, as you'd imagine.
Wow.
And but this is from 1814, from that fall, probably mid-October. And it's actually the sheet music is the first time that the title, the Star-Spangled Banner, is used. Because, you know, Key's own title is In Defense of Fort McHenry. But I think it was a really savvy commercial move for the publisher to put that title on top because he could sell it to the whole country, not just to the people in Baltimore. And it's also a key move that allows us to have that song escape, you know, the sort of history of that one little banner,
that pigeon
battle,
yeah,
exactly,
yeah,
and become something broader, sort of a more powerful symbol of our nation. But it features one of our students at the School of Music, Justin Berkowitz, and I've had the great fortune of having really an incredible talent pool at the School of Music here at Michigan to draw on, and they've been so generous, including my colleague Jerry Blackstone, who's our choral director, who led all of these recordings. But if you listen to it, it sounds very different. So it's a solo song. Right, it's not meant for mass singing, right? So originally it was the club president, and even in Key's day, it would have been sung by a fine vocalist you would have chosen to do the solo. And then there's an echo by chorus. So it's actually, you know, about an extra two phrases longer in its original version, because that last line, you know, "Oh say does that star-spangled banner yet wave, the land of the free and the home of the brave," that's repeated. First, it's sung by a soloist, and then it's repeated by the community, by the choir.
Almost like a little call and response.
Exactly. But it's a kind of affirmation, like, you know, this poem is here, and then the community sort of, you know, repeats and celebrates that lyric. It's a very different experience. The melody's different. It's much faster because initially it's a party tune, right? It's a song of celebration. We won, you know, as opposed to what it's become now, which is much more hymn-like, right? So it's slow. It's sacred. At the time, it's fast. It's exciting. It's meant to be a song of celebration. So, and the melodic contour is also a little different. I mean, there's subtle details, but it's really intriguing to hear.
Mark Clegg, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Great to be here, Cindy.
Mark Clegg is a musicologist with the University of Michigan and heads up the Poets and Patriots Project.
Fourth of July celebration means lots of traditions. Of course, fireworks, parades, and barbecues. And more often than not, it's the men doing the grilling. Why is that? Stateside's Renee Gross looks at why the guys are usually the ones manning the grill.
It's finally summertime, and the Wiley family in Holland, Michigan, is starting to grill again. Doug Wiley is doing the actual grilling.
Well, I'm going to try and cook these slow.
And his wife, Amanda Wiley, is taking care of the rest of the meal. The thought of grilling has never crossed her mind.
I definitely think that I could do it if I tried. I just haven't taken the time to do that.
Amanda does most of the cooking. She says there's no reason for her to grill. Her husband is really good at it, and she thinks for him, it's about more than just the food.
Feeling like if you are a good griller, then you've won some man card.
Doug feels like he's just repeating what his dad did.
That was always, I don't know, that's just what you've seen growing up.
And he enjoys barbecue.
She usually goes with a beer in a hand.
It was a very male-dominated, sort of testosterone-fueled activity.
That's Elizabeth Carmel. She's the author of multiple books on grilling and barbecue, and she's the executive chef of Hill Country Barbecue Market. She says the reason manliness and grilling go together goes beyond the meat.
It was more about just being outdoors and building a fire.
Of course, the link between barbecue and fire goes a long way back. And back in the old days, you didn't just roast a small piece of meat. You roasted whole animals, which may have made it difficult for women.
You know, a heavy activity required a lot of manual labor, a lot of lifting.
That was Robert Moss. He writes about the history of barbecue. But things have changed a lot. More and more women are starting to barbecue now. Back at the Wiley home, there's only one person that Doug would step aside for, and that's his daughter.
She can do anything. She can cut up a pig and serve it any way you wanted it, so...
Doug's daughter, Tess, is a chef at the White House Bistro in Saugatuck.
You know, in fact, yeah, if she was here, I would, you know, I'd let her have the tongs.
For Stateside, I'm Renee Gross.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just who is paying for all the campaign ads we've been watching in Michigan, those ads for the U.S. Senate and gubernatorial races? A new report finds that for every dollar spent by a Michigan candidate in campaign ads, outside groups have spent $3.50. Look at it another way. Of the $18 million spent on campaign TV ads for the first half of this year in Michigan, outside groups kicked in $14 million of that. Rich Robinson is executive director of the campaign spending watchdog group, Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Rich, just what do we know about where this $14 million in outside money is coming from?
You know, to a very large degree, we don't know much. We know who is associated with the leadership of some of these nonprofit corporations that have been the biggest spenders so far. But the one thing that we can say is that our elections have been nationalized. The financing is really not a function of state interest groups or individuals. And that goes for the gubernatorial as well as the U.S. Senate race. It's a lot of money coming from a lot of different places. And we know greater and lesser amounts about it depending on who the committee is.
Well, start with taking us further into your statement about that they're nationalized. Is that because of the recent rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think that's right. It has opened up for a lot of big money interests and individuals who have a lot of different kinds of interests at play to spend money all over the country. And, you know, for example, the biggest spender on the Democratic side of the U.S. Senate race has been the Senate Majority Fund. And the biggest donors there have been Fred Eichner, who prints a number of newspapers in Chicago, and Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York. So there aren't many Michiganders on that list, yet that organization has spent almost over $2 million on television, basically critical to Terry Land.
And then on the other side, that's right, because there's a flip side to that.
On the other side, and a much greater amount of money, over $6 million, at the top are two nonprofit corporations closely associated with Charles and David Koch. One is the Freedom Partners. They call it the Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce, and that's a business association, a 501c6 corporation that raises money from individuals, and it spreads that money out through a number of 501c4 social welfare corporations, chief among them being Americans for Prosperity. So between the two of them, they've spent $5 million on television ads, mostly on the theme of Gary Peters has supported the Affordable Care Act, and that's bad for your life.
So, and these outside groups really don't have the same disclosure laws as the candidates have to deal with, right?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Basically, of that $6.3 million spent by independent third-party groups in the U.S. Senate race on the Republican side, only $300,000 comes from disclosed sources. So 95% of it is coming from anonymous sources. What's wrong with that? Well, after the election, when an office holder starts moving public policy, voting on issues, we want to make sure we know who they're responding to. And interest groups and individuals don't write 5-, 6-, and 7-figure checks for selfless reasons. They've got policy agendas. And to keep everything on the up and up, transparency is inoculation against corruption. And so when such a large amount of money is coming from undisclosed sources, we don't really know what their ultimate policy goals are. Yes, they want tax cuts or smaller government, but what beyond that? What removal of a wind energy tax cut or extension of an oil depletion tax credit? You know, all kinds of different interests. So just in general, it's important for the integrity of public policy that the sources putting the big money in are recognized.
And if we continue along this path, Rich Robinson, What do you see this doing to our political system, you know, leading up past the November election and looking beyond?
I think what it does is make the development of public policy more responsive to the money interests that are driving the campaigns. And I don't think those are necessarily the interests that are always reflective of the broad public interest. And sometimes I think there is outright corruption involved in some of the flow of money in politics. So I think for public policy and the public interest, we really need to have transparency restored to our campaign finance process at all levels, state and federal.
And what would that take when you consider it's kind of, you know, who's mining the store? Who's the one benefiting from all of this? The very people you're asking to take off the curtains and shed more light into the process.
Well, not only that, it's really asymmetric in politics. The dark money so far evident in these campaigns is mostly on the Republican side of things. And there have been reflections of that in the past in Congress. You know, the House Democrats passed a transparency bill when they last had the majority in Congress. It was blocked in the U.S. Senate by a filibuster. So by the threat of a supermajority, we weren't able to get a disclosure law passed in Congress. Right now, with the House Republicans firmly in control, I don't anticipate there's going to be any legislation. And, you know, the unfortunate thing about this is there was a time when a lot of Republicans would say, just let people spend whatever they want and make sure everything is disclosed. Well, now that everybody can spend whatever they want, they've backed away from the disclosure side of things. And I don't think that's a credit to the Republican Party.
And I just think as citizens, there's really nothing a citizen can do to change this except be aware of it. And I guess what? Look at those commercials and take it with a huge chunk of salt?
I think that's right. But, you know, there's a complication on this, too. Millennials don't watch television on a schedule. Everything they do is on demand. And I think political advertisers, along with all other advertisers, have a new paradigm to look at in the future. How are they going to spend the money?
And it's interesting to think here we are. It's only the beginning of July. We have a lot of weeks ahead until November. So that $18 million, we know it isn't going to stop there. That's been spent.
There'll be a lot more spent between. In fact, in going through the public files, collecting these data, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has buys through October. The Democratic Governors Association has buys through September and October. The Michigan Republican Party has buys through October. There's a lot of money already put down. So we'll have no dearth of political advertising to everyone's delight this fall.
Yeah, thanks for reassuring us, Rich. Rich Robinson is with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. As always, thanks for talking with us, Rich.
Thank you, Cindy.
Say nice things about Detroit. That cheery slogan was first launched in the 70s and 80s by Emily Gale. Emily had a shop in downtown Detroit when it was the murder capital of the nation, and she grabbed a lot of attention with her slogan, and now the slogan's been revived. But my next guest believes Say Nice Things About Detroit really isn't helping. James David Dixon is the commentary editor at the Detroit News. His opinion piece, Why I Refuse to Say Nice Things About Detroit, was on his Detroit News blog and also his Tumblr blog, downi94.tumblr.com. James, what is so wrong with Say Nice Things About Detroit?
Well, there's nothing wrong with saying nice things about Detroit. It's just the insistence that we do it. I notice it typically comes from people who are not getting their hands dirty. Okay, so I talk about, or I show a picture of blight on my blog, and they say, well, that's just ruin porn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if you look at the whole blog, I mean, that is one of many stories told. I even did a photo set about the new Whole Foods in town. So we try to tell stories from the high to the low, but when you say that this particular part of the story is off limits in a city where there's 300 murders a year, that's out of line.
in your piece, I'll read a quote, and I thought this was really perfectly put. Here's the quote. At this fragile moment, when people whose parents told them to avoid Detroit are finally giving it a chance, there is a feeling that we need to pull out the good china for our guests, that we need to hide what's ugly behind the curtain and focus on the good. And what happens when that happens, James?
Well, what happens is that you run out of runway pretty quickly. You know, we have the 7.2 square miles of the greater downtown area, so that's, you know, downtown, midtown, Corktown. And first of all, not all 7.2 is all good. Then if you venture out of it into the 90% of the city that isn't that, if people are telling you to say nice things about Detroit and everything you see when you drive around indicates otherwise, you're not going to believe those people. So it's not a slogan that stands up. The more you love Detroit, the more you explore Detroit, the more you know that that's a lie.
Isn't saying nice things, whatever they may be, about Detroit and looking for the good, isn't that a start in the right direction? And isn't it better than some of the things that outsiders have been slinging at Detroit for, lo, these many years?
Well, it's funny because I end up encountering both groups in my blogging and on my own website. Part of why I focus on the art and the beauty of Detroit is that I want to give people ammunition when their neighbors are saying, oh, that's just a terrible place, it's not safe, you can't go there. Well, there's a lot you can do there, and there's a lot of exploring to be done, and I think you'll be surprised by what you see. I'm constantly surprised as I drive around, you know, from mile roads to main roads, what I see on any given corner. And what I want is for people to understand they can do that same journey. You can drive around just like I do. You can go see this thing. So let's not worry about whether people are saying nice or mean things. Let's actually explore so we know what we're talking about.
And that's why you created your Tumblr photo blog, right? Down I-94?
Absolutely. And one thing that has just jumped off the page since I started is I'll hear from people who've been in Detroit 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, their whole lives, who won't know about these things that I'm posting. And I just think that if we love Detroit the way we claim to, and if we take the interest that we claim to, let's do it. Let's get in our car. Let's come down to the city, see what's there. And then when you're here, get out of your car and explore. 700,000 real people live here.
And that slogan with the little heart, say nice things about Detroit, does it feel like a Band-Aid to you, or does it just feel like just a little happy flag people wave and think that they've done their bit?
Well, one thing that I think is extremely telling is that one of the most prominent places you'll see that slogan up is at the new Whole Foods.
Yeah, and you're right about that. I'm trying to decide. I don't think you're saying it's a bad thing, is it, that Whole Foods and Meijer are coming back to Detroit? Because one of the things we've often heard is Detroiters needed a place to go and be able to, you know, a good source of fresh food.
Absolutely. And I patronize the Meijer on 8 Mile pretty regularly. So I have no problem with Whole Foods, no problem with Meijer. I have a problem when people look at those outliers and say, that's the real Detroit, that's the story we need to tell, and you people showing the burned down buildings, you guys are doing us a disservice. And so my question really is, can you still love Detroit once you get to know it? See, it's not all the Tigers, and it's not just Meijer, and it's not just the DIA. When you really see the city, warts and all, do you still love it?
When you think about Detroit, James, I'm wondering, as you drive around and you look at the city and you talk to people and you reflect these travels on your Tumblr blog and in your writing in the Detroit News, what's your biggest hope? And on the flip side, what is your biggest fear for this city?
I'll start with the fear. Like I mentioned in the piece, I'd say at least half the city is of a condition that if I were to take a picture of it and post it, people would say, oh, that's just ruin porn. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what you see when you look out your window. And my fear is that what we really have, we have two things here. Last 50 years, I think, represent probably the biggest collective failure in any American city in history. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is from City Hall to the school system. A lot of people who were paid to keep Detroit solvent and safe and to keep your kid educated didn't do their jobs. But also you drive around neighborhoods and you see so many homes that are, it looks like a wrecking ball hit them. And that's also the problem of the people who live there. Everyone fell on their duty here.
So the Pollyanna approach of say nice things about Detroit really glosses over that, doesn't even address that.
Well, what I'd like to do is these people, I'm not even going to tell you to not tell me to say nice things. Say what you want.
Mm-hmm.
But are you willing to get your hands dirty? Are you going to pick up a shovel? Are you going to help educate a kid? Are you going to tell the side of the story that you think me or other people aren't telling? Are you going to take some active role in making the city better, or is it just language policing? Because that is going to be limited effectiveness.
Yeah. All right. Well, you told us your biggest fear. What's your biggest hope?
My biggest hope is that at the end of this major collective failure is that a lot of people do what you see happening in Woodbridge, and they take over these neighborhoods one house at a time, one mural on an abandoned house at a time, and that people say, we have a big undertaking on our hands, and that everyone does their role, because there's not going to be any savior. There's not going to be any Washington or Lansing who's going to do that. It's going to be a lot of people who could have chosen to live in a suburb where they would be comfortable saying, you know what, I'm going to rehab a house and help rehab a neighborhood. Those are very different pitches, and the second one, the one that Detroit needs to win you with, is much tougher. It's the toughest way to win, and that's exactly where we are. We are in a tough situation right now, and I hope we are all up for it.
The editorial piece is Why I Refuse to Say Nice Things About Detroit. James David Dixon, the commentary editor at the Detroit News, and you can find his blog, Down I-94. Just go to downi94.tumblr.com. James, it was good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time, Cindy.
And on our next stateside, will up north cottages become a thing of the past?
You put up a cute log place on one of these trout streams. You're all proud of it. You get a good price on it. You post it on the internet. You do a mailing, and you get zero response. And it's just like, oh, my goodness, what's going on here?
The future of up north cottages. Listen for that on Monday. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saadeh, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Michelle Hun. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.